Hey everyone, welcome. It's Eugene, and we're back for another episode of Forensics Talks here. So today is episode 100. So I'm now into the three digits, which is pretty cool. And I want to say thanks to all the folks who I've seen in the chat window regularly. They keep coming back, so I haven't scared them away just yet, which is great. And comments and great feedback. I know that people have been using these for university, like lectures and things like that, and have been referencing some of these talks, which is great. And, you know, I can give you just a little bit of background on how this all started. And really, it was just an idea to discuss some of the work that I was doing. And I thought I would invite some of my colleagues and friends that are doing similar work. But I realized after 30 seconds that that was going to get pretty boring pretty fast. So I thought, hey, let's just open it up to all areas of forensics and areas that are completely out of my wheelhouse, just like our guest today. It's not my area of expertise, but it's really fascinating what people are doing in so many different areas of forensics. And if you're a student and, you know, you're looking at different careers in forensics, that this is one avenue of, you know, looking at the different options that are out there. It's not always the traditional, maybe lab work or DNA work or some of the things that are taught inside of school. And so hopefully this will give you some ideas or some areas of interest. And so, yeah, look, I don't know. You know, I was thinking about if I had to do some kind of a celebration for the 100th episode, but I think just we're going to continue on, going to continue doing forensics talks going forward. Plenty of speakers, plenty of things to learn from. So yeah, thank you again, everyone. Really appreciate it. And I'm happy to do these. I've learned a lot from all the guests and the speakers that we've had here. Okay, we're going to get going. I can see people have been commenting already. So we've got people from London. Hey, Ruth. Hey, welcome. Kyan, hey, glad you're here. Mr. Goddard as well. Excellent to see you here. So let's get going. My guest today is Gary Delaney. And actually, I was in England not too long ago, and I was invited to the Leica public safety event that they had. There was a two-day event where a lot of people were talking about different aspects of forensics, but mostly around, you know, terrestrial laser scanning. But Gary did a presentation there, and I really enjoyed his presentation. I thought it was super cool, some of the things he was talking about and some of the cases that he's been working on. And so that's kind of how he's here today. So thank you to Marcus Rowe for putting that on. And, you know, it was great to meet some of the people there face to face. So Gary's background, well, he's a seasoned geospatial expert, and he began his career in the 1980s and as a naval officer and a specialist navigator. I mean, he's literally navigated through waters from the Atlantic to the near Middle East, you know, mastering the art of precise positioning under, you know, different challenging conditions. And since transitioning sort of from the Navy, he's taught at various universities, lectured, and he's dedicated over 25 years to, you know, advancing geospatial applications in both land and marine domains, specializing in everything from GPS, GNSS systems to advanced surveying techniques. And through his presentation, I noticed that, you know, he's applied his expertise in all kinds of different areas. So some being just, you know, homicide cases right up to, you know, very large scale drug smuggling, pirating cases and things like that. So I'm going to bring him in here. There he is. Gary, how are you?
Good afternoon. How are you doing? And I'm very honored to be here on your 100th episode. Thank you for inviting me along, and hello to everybody watching in.
Yeah, great. It's great that we could connect, and I'm glad that I had a chance to see your presentation. And, you know, just from watching you at the presentation, you know, I was just like, this guy knows what he's talking about. He's been around for a while, so I think he's seen a few things here and there. So it was great, and it was great that it wasn't about just laser scanning too. I was going to ask you about that, because I have no idea. How did you get connected there or get into that? Was it through Marcus, or who connected you?
Well, as I mentioned before, I don't tend to put my name around too much, in the sense that here, especially criminal activity in Ireland, is a small world, so you don't really want your name too much around in relation to what you do. But at the same time, through various industry connections, you know, your name travels. And because I was involved in the survey world and survey instrumentation, people that would know Marcus knew me through that, and that's how that connection happened.
Well, let's start with some of your background. I mean, you've got, you know, Navy and that sort of thing, but let's go back even before then. I mean, does your family have sort of a naval or military background, or what got you involved initially with the Navy?
no Navy, no military. All my family are aviation. And I got fed up listening to airplanes at the kitchen table having dinner. And I said, I've got to find some other way. And the Navy emerged from that. And that's not unusual in my naval career. I suppose a lot of people go to sea, you know, just on the hope that it will fulfill their requirements. And I actually started doing electrical engineering in college in Dublin. And the labs were a bit dull, and I got an invitation to become an officer in the Navy. So that seemed like a better idea at the time.
Okay, so fun fact, I started in electrical engineering, and what you just said is exactly the reason why I switched to aerospace engineering. So very interesting. I guess the labs are the killers for the people going through electrical. If you can get through the labs and you enjoy the labs, then you're okay. But yeah, that's very interesting. So when you started with the Navy, was there a certain direction that you knew already, like you were heading into, or what was your progression like through there?
Well, first of all, I was inducted as a seagoing or seaman officer, now called operations officer. So I knew that I was going to be in the kind of bridge work, the navigation area, the ship management area of things. And of course, that's joined up with the military aspect. So I also understood that I would start in Ireland, start with the army. So you start training with the army, and then very shortly after that, I ended up with the Royal Navy in the UK training there, and spent 2 years training there. And that was in the early 80s, which you can imagine was a little bit difficult for an Irish person in the UK, but we were treated exceptionally well, and learned very well as well, and spent some time on Royal Navy ships getting experience. So most of the experience then would be about navigation. So that was kind of the starting point to where I am now, is the key aspect of any vehicle, I suppose, is safely getting it from A to B. And that's the definition of navigation.
Yeah, but you also have a surveying background. So, I mean, like, was that a conscious decision for you, or did you kind of fall into it, or was it something that you pursued on your own?
Well, the whole idea of precisely positioning a ship or any vehicle or any device, really, kind of, you know, came natural after being a navigator. And I was the kind of guy that was the guy that broke the GPS trying to find out how it worked. So it interested me to go further into the electronic side of things, into the data formats and the analysis and all those kind of things. So that kind of naturally took me into Nottingham University, where I did precise positioning and navigation technology. And that was the technology side of things, which again introduced the survey element of things. So when I left the Navy, which was after nearly 20 years, I actually started to be an agent for a fairly prominent survey company, American survey company, and that kind of led me straight down the road of precise surveying and GPS and GNSS and all those kind of things. So how I ended up into the forensic side is that literally I have had my hands on every type of GPS. I've installed them in tractors for farmers to drive blind at night, and deliberately for testing with screens on their windows for precise spreading of fertilizer and planting, seed planting, all that kind of stuff. I've sold, supported, and repaired and trained people in surveying GPS, in GPS for GIS, and in marine GPS. So every aspect of the performance of GPS I've seen in all the different domains. And I also then at one point was reselling Garmin devices. So I could see it from the consumer perspective, which is a large part of what I do now, because it's through consumer devices that the geospatial evidence comes in a lot of cases. So I've amassed a lot of kind of experience and knowledge about how these things work, how they break, how people use them, and what trace is left behind when they're used. And the electronic something side of things then, and access to data sharing, all those kind of things is something that has come by experience as well. And every aspect of that I use in what I do, from the simple act of extracting data from devices to making it into a map, to doing the analysis, to presenting it then as evidence, which is I suppose 40 years nearly of experience from Navy to being a reseller and a trainer and all those kind of things right to now. And it's, you know, I don't know whether people fall into forensics, but it's something that has just evolved for me. The GPS man, I get referred to, and I'm the guy who can never get lost when he's going anywhere or never be late. I'm supposed to know. I don't presume anything, but you know, some people go to college to do forensics, and literally my forensic expertise comes from all the stuff that I did in a career since I left college.
Yeah. And I mean, GPS is, I mean, you mentioned, you know, farming equipment, they're in vehicles. Well, let's see, people have them in their phones. They have them in their, you know, just so many different devices. So there's billions and billions of instruments out there that must have GPS. So we'll talk about some of the problems, but I'd like to ask you just to help ground everybody on the basic system, a basic GPS system and how that works. And there was a graphic you sent me, and I'm just going to bring that up here, but could you give us just an outline of how these things work and maybe point out some of the areas that are important for what we're going to discuss, like their vulnerabilities and why?
Yeah, so I suppose the most important thing is that the calculation on Earth of your position with GPS, or GNSS nowadays, more popularly referred to Global Navigation Satellite Systems, which includes more than American GPS. So broadly, it's called GNSS nowadays, is based on satellite technology, dedicated satellite technology. And essentially, if you have a GPS receiver, you have an electronic stopwatch. That's what you have. And that electronic stopwatch measures the time it takes for a signal to get from the satellite to your GPS receiver. And because we know the speed of light, we can calculate speed by time equals distance. We can calculate distance. And simply by having that electronic stopwatch, which needs huge code correlation, so all kinds of binary code matching and things like that going on there, but basically a stopwatch, if you can calculate distances to three satellites at the same time, then you have a two-dimensional fix. And if you can do it for four or more, then you have three-dimensional and upwards from there. And by dimensional, we mean that we can calculate position and time. And time is very, very important, and it gets forgotten, but is a key element to evidence. The vulnerabilities of all this, of course, it's very readily usable, and everybody is using it. And to some extent, you know, it's presented as being infallible. So as a navigator, I was always taught later on that you never rely on one source of positioning information. There's always cross-checking. And as a surveyor, you do the same thing. So we try in forensics to identify what the kind of vulnerabilities are and ensure in any analysis that we do that those vulnerabilities are covered off, whether it be from a defense or a prosecution point of view. And the biggest vulnerability of GPS is that it travels a long distance. It's a microwave signal that travels at least 22,000 kilometers. And so it's extremely weak by the time it gets to your electronic stopwatch, your receiver. And if it's weak, then it can be interfered with very easily. And that's the crux of some of the things maybe that we're going to talk about and how GPS is vulnerable, but also how, if it's presented as evidence, some of the evidence may not be as reliable as we believe it to be. And you rightly said that GPS is ubiquitous, is everywhere. And that assumption is something that we need to conquer and advise about always and be careful about when we use positioning as evidence, geospatial positioning as evidence.
Obviously the basic principle of GPS or GNSS has been more or less the same for, you know, decades and decades. But what has been probably like the largest change in, you know, GPS systems over the past, you know, 10, 20, 30 years? Has there been anything that's really changed, or is it kind of the same?
The accuracy, the potential accuracy has improved. That's number one. So some people might remember the idea that there were deliberate errors in GPS, what they call selective availability. So the year 2000, having a GPS that was good enough to navigate you on a road really didn't exist, because the errors were so big that it didn't support that, except maybe if you were going across the desert, it would be suitable, or marine navigation obviously was the starting point. So that's number one, the accuracy has changed. But the proliferation of use is enormous. So again, it is ubiquitous. It's in every form of thing that we might do. So therefore, as you said, vehicles, marine navigation, all those things in our phones, in our devices, in our watches, it is everywhere. So therefore, it leaves a very significant trace, which is largely reliable. But when it's used in a phone device, the positioning is being contributed to not just by GNSS, but by other services, location services, which can undermine the reliability or the accuracy of the solution that may be presented in evidence. So that's something that we look at. So the biggest thing is it's become very accurate. And the next thing is, because it's become very accurate, it's ubiquitous, it's proliferated into every possible walk of life and possible uses and possible devices.
I mentioned the other day that I was driving in, and just 2 days ago in the morning, and on the radio, the first time I've ever heard anything like it, said, you know, they brought up this thing about GPS attacks and GPS spoofing. And I'm like, well, great. I'm talking to Gary in 2 days. So it's amazing that they brought this up, and they were talking about it being used for, you know, in wars and things like this. But I guess there's, if I may break it up this way, and you can, whatever, if you tell me it's not a good way to go, but there's sort of a natural or I'll say less malicious things that happen with GPS that just, it's just the nature of maybe how it works, or maybe it's the devices that are being used or something. And then there's obviously the things that people do consciously to block jam or like whatever. So can we talk about some of the things that could go wrong, like in some of the cases where, you know, it's not somebody doing something, it's just the nature of the device or whatever that's happening. Like what kinds of things can happen naturally, let's say?
So in terms of accuracy, we kind of rely on GPS, GNSS, to be precise. But obviously, when you get into a crime scene, that precision has to be challenged in all kinds of ways. The average accuracy globally of your basic GPS receiver, unenhanced, uncorrected GPS, is probably in the order of plus or minus 10 meters. But that doesn't mean that it's plus or minus 10 meters all the time. But even if it is plus or 10 meters, potentially that's somebody the other side of a riverbank or a railway, and therefore not quite immediately accessible to a scene. So that's something that has to be considered, and has to be considered in terms of the potential. Now, generally, because we don't deal with a single example of a position or just one position, we're never just taking one. We have a whole series of positions which perform a track or a route or whatever. They give us some sort of backup and some sort of reliance in what we're looking at. The other thing then is a thing called GPS rollover. And this is something I've come across quite a bit. And GPS rollover has the potential not only to give you error in your GPS position, but that's fairly easily solved. But it also has the potential to affect timing, because what GPS rollover, date and time rollover, is about is the fact that the code that's used for the binary correlation in the signal that this electronics stopwatch rolls over or changes every 1,024 weeks. So that's roughly 19 and a half years. And, you know, we all know of the year 2K rollover, and same idea. So when the GPSs were built, they were built with the idea that, you know, someone will buy something new or it won't be an issue by the time we get to the first rollover, which was in 1999. And when that happens, obviously the time starts again for the GPS receiver. So therefore it reverts to 20 years earlier. A simple power reset will fix the GPS position, but it won't fix the time. So in one instance, I had a case where a GPS receiver, waypoints are very interesting. And waypoints, people will be familiar with waypoints, because if you go fishing or hunting or whatever, you record a point that you might be of interest to you. And when you record that, not only do you have the coordinates, the GPS position, and maybe put your name on it, or a name on it rather than a number, you also have a time and a date. The very fact that it's been created from a kind of geospatial evidence or forensic point of view shows an intent. It shows that you were either there or you intended to go there. But if the time and date is wrong, obviously, when you're looking at these devices, you have a range of time of interest, but may well say, well, okay, that's too old. So it didn't happen. What didn't happen in the time that I'm that's of interest to me? And that actually was an issue in two cases in the last 10 years for me, where if I hadn't checked the software version, if I didn't check manufacturers' notices about rollovers and things like that, maybe we wouldn't have noticed it. And then we would have eliminated from the evidence several waypoints, points of interest, that actually were crucial in the long term. So, you know, the important thing really is to understand that GPS produces date and time. It's not system time, it's GPS, part of the calculation. But the calculation runs from 1 to 1,024 weeks and then resets. And sometimes what happens is the software manufacturer or the unit manufacturer will put a little bug fix, a little software fix that allows that to run on for two or three extra years. So now we might have in our head 1999, 2019, 2039, they're the rollover times, and if it hasn't happened, then it's fine. But if there's a bug fix that gives you a 2 or 3 year rollover, and this only happens after 2 or 3 years, that even complicates the issue, and that has happened. And I believe it's something I haven't seen it myself on in infotainment systems, navigation systems, and vehicles. But I believe it is an issue now for older devices. And again, if you're extracting from vehicles, that's something that needs attention.
So, for example, something that many people might be fairly common or have seen before, you know, just using their navigation system, and sometimes you're driving along and all of a sudden, you know, you're somewhere else. It jumps over to something and you're like, what the heck is going on? This thing has no idea what it's doing. Is this just a case of weak signal, interrupted signal, or, you know, something like that?
Yeah, well, it depends on the location. So we have all kinds of environmental. I tell people regularly that GPS is a measurement device, but it's not like a voltmeter or an ammeter. You put the two contacts onto the end of the wire and you measure voltage and it's always the same. Yeah, GPS doesn't do that because the environment is critical. So, for instance, in urban canyon, as they say, in city areas with large buildings, you can have reflected signal. And because we're dealing with timing, this electronic stopwatch, if the signal doesn't come directly to your receiver, it gets bounced off glass surfaces, reflective surfaces, and therefore it introduces this thing called multipath. And multipath introduces position errors. Now, if the order of error you're talking about is 20 or 30 meters or 40 meters from one side of the street to the other, or maybe an adjacent street, that would account for that. And that does happen, and that can happen in rural areas as well, where you have a lot of trees. And again, because the signal is weak, GPS doesn't like physical obstructions, so you can have that kind of thing going on. And multipath could be, but that's again because in a vehicle, for instance, you're traveling along, generally it rectifies itself. And from a forensic point of view, if you're looking at a stream of data and you're mapping that and you see this one or two strange positions that don't feed with the rest of them, then, you know, we can put that down to the Gaussian curve and the fact that most of them are good. GPS sat navs, as they're properly referred to, the ones we use in car, do funny things. There's a bit of filtering going on there to say, well, you should be on a road rather than, you know, in the buildings, so we'll fix that. And that goes on as well. You stop at traffic lights and you find that the vehicle or the track marker on your screen goes past the traffic lights, looks behind and says, oh, he stopped, I better go back and meet him. That's just filtering that goes on by manufacturers to make things look better. That's presentation. But that doesn't tend to present itself in what you might extract from the device.
In a case like, I don't know, let's say it's a homicide case or something, you're trying to track a suspect and they have their phone, or, for example, you know, you're driving your car. The actual device, like I've always heard, for example, L1, like an L1, class L1 device in a phone. How is that? Is that the same sort of device that would be in most vehicles, or how are the different classes of GPS devices sort of different?
So L1 is a frequency, about 1200 megahertz. Yeah. So if you think of your mobile phone, somewhere around the 900 megahertz. So it's in that microwave band, and L1 is your standard frequency for GPS since day one. So it's an ordinary GPS receiver on L1. If you have L2 in there as well, then you're into second frequency, which GPS always has. Most of us don't have access to positioning, direct positioning from that, because it's coded for military use. But the combination of the two gives us better accuracy. And when we get into surveying, we're using the combination of both L1 and L2 for phase measurements. So instead of measuring time, we still measure time, but you're into measuring the phase of the signal as it's received, which gives you much better accuracy down to centimeter level. So your ordinary phone, but now most phones now have not only L1 and L2, but that's GPS, but they'll also have GLONASS, which is Russian GPS, and they'll also have Galileo, which is European GPS, and they may well have Beidou, which is Chinese GPS. So instead of seeing 4 or 5 satellites, you're seeing 70 satellites. Now, more satellites doesn't mean more accuracy, because, you know, with triangulation, which are distance measurements, you need good angles. It's the same as basic navigation or resection. Anyone that uses a compass in land navigation, you know that you need about 30 degrees between your measurements, your resections, to get a decent angle. Same thing with scanning and all those. All the principles are the same. They don't change. However, you've got redundancy, and you know where you've got physical masking and things like that. The redundancy of those extra satellites will give you more reliability. But one of the great things that happens when you have more satellites is that spoofing and jamming are much more difficult to do, and that they're the ones that become issues, you know, in a military environment. But jamming is something that, because again the signal is weak, it's very easy to distract your GPS receiver and say, because it's whispering compared to everything else, if you shout at it with the GPS signal or another signal that just blasts out everything, then it's distracted and it can't work out position. But if you want to spoof it, much more difficult, because you have to mimic the signal, rebroadcast and mimic the signal. But that definitely is a military type application, and it's something that's very prominent right now in the Baltic and various other places where Russians might be involved at the moment. And that's something very significant.
So if you were to categorize the different things that people do, there would be, okay, so one is to say, hey, I'm not here, I'm here. Like just telling it you're someplace else. So that's one thing you could do. But can you do anything, for example, with time, which says, well, I'm here, but I wasn't here at this time, I was here at a different time or something, or is that harder to do?
Well, again, because timing is a key part of the signal. So if you do anything with the signal, if you jam it, you just don't have anything. And that's very easy to spot. If you're downloading data from a device for evidence and there's nothing there, then you start thinking about what was the jamming going on. And, you know, a basic low-cost $5 device inside in your vehicle in the cigarette lighter can help you jam. What people do forget, though, is if that's inside in your vehicle, plugged into the cigarette lighter, and your antenna for your GPS is outside, then it may not have the impact that you expect. However, they're used mostly commercially. Commercial vehicles, as you know, would be tracked nowadays. Where are you? Why were you late to get to the customer? You know, can you get back here for another delivery, et cetera, et cetera. And people don't like being tracked when they're taking a sneaky break on the side of the road or maybe other things. So people will use jammers, and you know, we've all heard, oh, my GPS didn't work. So without understanding that, people may well accept it with the device, a jammer. But take that onto an industrial scale. Something like that might be only of a quarter of a watt. Very marginally will affect your vehicle, maybe a vehicle beside you. But take that into 10 or 20 watts on a military scale, and you can do serious damage. And when you're doing that, you mentioned timing. Obviously, you're blocking out timing. So what uses timing? Lots of things use timing. So all your cell transmissions, mobile phone masts, as we call them here in Europe, all those transmissions are timed with GPS. bank transactions, international banking exchanges, all those things are timed with GPS. So it has happened. It's happened in London. It's happened elsewhere. You park a vehicle outside a bank or an exchange or an airport, where it's even more critical, and you jam GPS. You may not, you know, there is lots of subsidiary and secondary systems will help aircraft land, for instance, but the timing will be shattered. So timing then, if you're into buying and selling shares and you don't have exact timing attached to that, you can potentially win millions and transfer millions in microseconds because GPS timing has affected. So there's a commercial value in jamming as well. So that's jamming, relatively easy done because the signal is weak. But the next one then would be spoofing, where you have to take a lookalike coded GPS signal, GNSS signal, and make a receiver believe it's seeing a real signal, but the position, the almanac, the readings have changed. So they put the device and the vehicle in a completely different location. In the marine and air navigation worlds, and probably in road navigation, well, you kind of look and say, well, I know something has gone wrong here because it says I'm on 22nd Street when I'm actually on 19th Street, and I know I am because I can see the signs. So that's obvious. And in marine navigation, air navigation, as I said earlier, we're taught from day one to use backup systems to cross-reference between different systems. So it's obvious that that something is strange is happening. But if it's an unmanned ballistic missile or other missile, then it doesn't know it's been spoofed. If it's a drone, and we know we've heard a lot about drones and drone munitions nowadays, they don't know they're being spoofed. And sometimes military pilots who really don't have the time to be cross-checking their position, they're totally relying on their instruments, they can be spoofed into an area where they become targetable, whereas otherwise they won't. So spoofing is a big deal. In the normal criminal world, is it possible? You know, if we're talking about forensic evidence, stuff like that, well, it is. It's not beyond the value of drug cartels and people like that nowadays to do that. What's the value? The value is if you jam a GPS, you say, okay, well, they jammed it. So that's kind of nefarious in itself. We just need to prove that. But if they present themselves as being somewhere else entirely, that's now a difficult piece of evidence that we have to counter from either a prosecution point of view or we could use from a defense point of view. So all of that is possible, and it's possible with a piece of software and a transmitter. So, yeah, it's easy. Now, you know, you can progress that. And what I've seen most in my career from the forensic point of view is simulation, GPS simulation. So you're not broadcasting now. So the GPS receiver is not receiving information over the air. What it is instead doing is it may be receiving information, or a transmitting device is receiving information from a software device which is making itself look like a GPS and send data over a cable, over a communication link, which is presenting itself to someone else and saying, look where I am. And that look where I am may not be actually where a vessel or an aircraft or a car is. And that can be done with a laptop, a cable, and a communication device. So when you're talking about tracking vehicles and tracking aircraft and tracking ships, that's very easy to do. How do you recognize that from a forensic point of view? It can be recognized reasonably well. If you're at sea and you steer a course, I'm going to steer north, 000 degrees. The ship rarely will actually achieve 000 degrees second by second. You'll have a little bit of yaw left and right of that. But if your data's coming back with 000000, you start looking and saying, there's something a bit strange about here. We need to look at this more. So there's that kind of, all that kind of thing that goes on. And if we started this conversation earlier with the assumption, GPS is brilliant, it always gets me where I need to go. Yeah, and that's fine. And the occasion that, as you say, Eugene, it shows me in the wrong street or something like that, well, we can live with that. But if we have to go into court and someone presents these things that I'm talking about to us, then we're now in a difficult situation where the whole reliability of evidence gets pulled into question. And that's not something that anybody that's looking at or listening or viewing today is not already used to. What I would like to champion, and what I'm trying to champion, is the assumption that because it's GPS, it's perfect. And in the days, in my days of training people, and another maybe 2,000 people that put through survey training with GPS, GIS, agriculture, all those things, the first thing I always have to do is convince people that it's not always going to give them exactly the same result, and that there are is potential for errors, and they need to be aware of those. And that's very difficult if somebody's coming to, you know, from consumer point of view, coming to GPS as you know, from a different industry or a different perspective. It's very difficult to convince people that it's more than just pressing the buttons. You need to understand the variability in the performance and the reliability.
Can you talk about some of the cases? I know I you presented some things like larger cases where there was, you know, smuggling, pirating. I know there was a homicide case you worked on where you were commended and whatever. So I don't want to say too much about some of these. I'll let you offer whatever. But perhaps maybe some of the, maybe just talk about in general, like what some of the difficulties or the challenges were in these cases and what may have happened. If it was, you know, exactly what some of the things you're talking about, whether spoofing involved or was somebody saying, no, I was here. We were actually here. We weren't where you think we were or something like that. But what are some of the cases you can talk about?
Yeah. So from a drugs point of view, a drugs importation point of view, and it's no different here in Europe than it is in North America and Canada and everywhere else, there is a large volume of material coming into being imported. And it's coming in all kinds of different ways. And no expense has been spared. And it used to be the case that somebody might buy a yacht and navigate it across the Atlantic. And in one case, those people never navigated a boat before. And they were told, here's a GPS jammer. Use that. And if there's a tracker on board, nobody will see you or find you. But the guys had never used GPS, let alone a GPS jammer. So they were afraid to put on the GPS jammer in case the GPS wouldn't work afterwards. And they were totally reliant on it. Okay. And these guys, after several days at sea, were about to give up. Well, they were about to dump the cocaine. And then so we'll persist. And eventually they kind of, with seasickness, they'd spilled diesel. And diesel on a yacht inside is not a nice smell. And if you're not used to going to sea and all the rest. So these guys were practically ready to give up, you know. But all part of that was the GPS jammer. And, okay, it didn't affect any of the evidence we had. The evidence was good evidence. Some evidence, by the way, doesn't come necessarily from being on board, directly on board. Some evidence comes from communications devices, satellite communications. And those... satellite communications, satellites, low Earth orbit satellites nowadays triangulate and calculate position as well. So some of that comes, and there's a good cooperation, intercontinental cooperation between agencies to get access to that data. It doesn't reside on board a vessel or in a vehicle. It resides in a server somewhere else. And we have to get access to that, and we readily available and usable. Then you have the situation where, for all kinds of reasons, mostly because of the country that you're going to, which is conspicuous, where you're starting your voyage from, you don't want the rest of the world to see that's where you are, so you use simulated GPS. And that's effectively a computer which generates a course and speed and position, updates, sends it over a cable to a communication device, which is sent off to somewhere else. The other thing then is nowadays we have this idea of, it's referred to as semantic position. And this is something people should be very much aware of if they're extracting position information from mobile phone devices and from vehicles. And not so much vehicles nowadays, but I can imagine that it's something that is there or thereabouts. Semantic position is an inferred position based on maybe a Wi-Fi connection. I had to do a Wi-Fi design course recently. In the last 2 years, I did a Wi-Fi design course and said, what's Gary Delaney doing a Wi-Fi design course? Understand positioning possibilities from Wi-Fi. And, you know, the potential ranges, the reliability, the signal strengths, all that kind of stuff. And in some mobile phone devices, the position that is presented to you is a semantic or inferred position, depending on your choices. You know, the way now you can choose whether you're using GPS or other location services, whether it might be, of course, Cell ID, which people will be familiar with, which is less accurate, depending on where you are, of course. But add to that Wi-Fi now. So in other words, if you're outside the big popular store, you're driving past the big popular store and you happen to be stopped at traffic lights, and your phone sees the Wi-Fi with the name on it from that store, which certain big providers of internet and others know exactly where that is, then they can infer you were stopped there, so you're inside. Maybe correctly, maybe incorrectly. And that is something that I have come across in a homicide case, and it's something that you have to deal with. It can be very useful, but obviously you have to be conscious that it's not the primary evidence that you want. So semantic positioning, because phones are paired now with infotainment systems in vehicles, you need to be certain that any data that's coming out of that you might extract from an infotainment system is GPS. That's a good place to be, because we know exactly what we're dealing with. But if for any reason it's sharing location services, either Wi-Fi or Cell ID or otherwise, then you need to be aware of that. And maybe that's not as obvious as it could be or should be, and that's something that we need to be very conscious of now also. And I have trained in vehicle infotainment system extraction and all that kind of stuff with Berlin in the States. But I haven't actually used it in evidence yet, but I'm very conscious of it, of the possibilities associated. Also conscious of the possibilities for getting good results where otherwise you mightn't get results. Yeah. But that is something that is there to be dealt with.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of these systems. Well, especially when it's like a trucking company or something like this, it's, they want to keep track of all their people, whatever. So I've run across some of these before where, you know, we have a GPS and it's, you know, every second or so. So you, speed and position and all this sort of thing can be determined. But it's an interesting point. And I think you alluded to this too. You know, it's not just about the numbers that you're getting. It's about the errors that you have to try and figure out, which is maybe a little bit more difficult to determine. Just because the GPS says, you know, this is where it is, you don't know exactly, you know, what the timing and speed might actually be in truth.
Yeah, exactly. So your extracted data is a series of coordinates which place a point on a map. But how were they generated? What accuracy? What reliability? Again, this all goes back to, you know, again, why am I in this? Because I think that way. Because from day one in the navigation side of things, a single position fix from one source was never enough. It had to be backed up with something else. And in the same way, when people are surveying, a single measurement is never enough. It has to be backed up with multiple measurements. But also, we had this discussion only a couple of weeks ago. Loop closures and networks and all those things are vital. And it's all about triangulation, and that doesn't change. And if you can back it up with two or three individual sources, that's there. And so when you're looking at them, when I look at a latitude and longitude or a grid reference put on a piece of paper, I immediately ask, what reference datum was that associated with? What map can I put that on without transferring it? And WGS 84, people would be familiar with World Geodetic System 1984, but not every map around the world is based on that. I worked on a case, again, a drugs case in Seychelles. Archipelago, very old mapping, islands located kilometers from where they actually were. So resolving that latitude and longitude on that you see on a paper that's come from a GPS receiver actually to an actual spot that is meaningful on a map or a chart is another consideration. The second thing I look for after datum is then what generated. How was it generated and what was the reliability of that? And do I have a second or third or a continuous stream of data that proves a course and a speed or an intention or dynamics. And the dynamics are a part of the geospatial evidence. And dynamics can be very useful, again, especially in the marine side of things, because we can look at how vessels are interacting with the weather. Is that normal? Is it not normal? Are they slowing speed for long periods of time? Why might that be? Would they might be beside other vessels or might be working stuff that's in the water and all those things. And if you get repeatable information, not single point, but repeatable information, then you can start inferring certain things from those.
A question. So you're testifying at trial, and I'm just wondering if there have been any sort of memorable moments about, you know, your testimony. Are there any difficult questions that you get asked? Are there questions that regularly come up, you know, to you saying, ah, Gary, you know, it's, you know, the opposition or something is trying to say something different. But just curious about your general thoughts on testifying with to geospatial accuracy and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so the first thing that's always a matter of concern, especially in marine world, and happens on land if you have international boundaries close by, is jurisdiction. So to prove that something was imported, you have to show that the GPS receiver actually entered into your area or the national area of jurisdiction. So we have territorial waters of contiguous areas, all those kind of things offshore, and you have land boundaries on shore. So that's the first thing that you prove. And, you know, that's a combination of different things, legislation in relation to where those boundaries are, specified coordinates for those boundaries, and then the GPS in relation to that. So that's always something that has to be proven. Well, sorry, not always. If you're in the middle of the desert somewhere and there's no land boundaries around, not important. But in the marine world, it comes up quite a bit. The second thing then is people will always poke at GPS because everyone can relate to the fact that the GPS didn't work or that brought me to the wrong place. Yeah. So everyone has that kind of story. So throw that into the mix and certainly you can try start to undermine. But in one case, we had positioning from Iridium. Iridium, US low Earth orbit satellites. Iridium positioning isn't very, well, it's more accurate now, but in this particular case, we were talking about one plus or minus 1 to 2 kilometers. And because why was it useful? It was useful because we had much more accurate GPS over long periods of time. And we could see the progression of the Iridium with that. So we can infer the accuracy of Iridium. And you can start relating the communications to a person because it was in the same place or related to GPS in the same place, time and space, all those things. So in the court case, and it was very late on a Friday afternoon, you could imagine that a speed calculated from a positioning source that is plus or minus 1 kilometer can be interstellar type speeds. Yeah. And at that point, you know, somebody suggested that we made, or the defense in this case suggested that we made a major error in the calculation of speed. We should have done better. And we should have used the Mark St. Hilaire method. And the Mark St. Hilaire method is actually a method for presenting position differences calculated from celestial, from astronavigation. So instead of trying to present a distance to the sun on a chart, you present differences between what you expected and what you actually calculated. Mark St. Hilaire method. He didn't. The defense lawyer didn't realize that I taught celestial navigation, so we were able to put a hole in that fairly quickly. But certainly those kind of things. So you have to be navigation. If it's navigation related, having a background is useful with positioning. And then in relation to how the hell can you take something on the surface of the globe and send that on a flat piece of paper, and then you get into the whole idea of projections, coordinates, datums, WGS 84 and stuff like that. And they're the kind of things that get poked at. And ultimately, whether it be at sea, in the air, or inland, you know, accuracy and the reliability of the accuracy is always something that's questioned, especially if there's a lot on the line. And in cases that are big drug cartel cases, all of those things will be no more than any other element of forensics will be questioned. So it's useful to have a background rather than just presenting.
Let's take a couple of questions here. Just some questions that came up from before. I just want to take some of them here. And folks, if you have any questions, just go ahead and pop them in and I'll see how many we can get in here. Nicholas was asking about other things that affect the GPS, so solar storms and things like that, and then accuracy. I'm going to guess that the fewer satellites you can pick up, then the worse it's going to be.
Yeah, so solar flares and solar storms do affect GPS, but it wouldn't be in the kind of or that would the influence there would mostly be in precise positioning surveying. We're talking about centimeters generally, yeah, unless it's midday on the equator, in which case we might be talking about meters where you're nearest to the sun. But generally, and there's an 11-year cycle, so it's very, very predictable, or more or less predictable, solar flares. So it is a consideration. It wouldn't be a huge consideration, except in very specific zones for this area.
So, you know, you mentioned triangulation is important. So is it fair to say that having 10 signals or 10 satellites that are very, yep, very well spread out, let's say, and gives you really good triangulation is much better than having, you know, 20 sort of in the same direction, and if you have a very limited angle or something like that. Is that fair
Absolutely,
to say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and sometimes, not always, you can get a measure of that in PDOP, dilution of precision, or position dilution of precision. People might have seen that phrase used, PDOP. And if you can get a measure of that from the GPS, it's useful to present that as part of your evidence to do that. Again, with a moving object, you get reliability from the repeatability of the position along the track and so on. So that kind of helps you with respect to that.
We have another question here from Mike. Mike, welcome. He's asking, do you see any use of vehicle, I guess that's telematics, Wi-Fi, GPS in fire investigation, other than an obvious GPS or Wi-Fi handshakes acquisition of suspect and or victim?
I haven't come across that. But what comes to mind immediately is indoor positioning is an emerging thing, which is useful for firefighting in itself, but also the idea that devices and people working in areas can be triangulated and positioned indoors, and that can be very useful then for a fire investigation. I haven't seen it happen yet, but I can imagine that's something that is on the way.
Gary, I was going to ask you about like research. I mean, you were teaching for some time at some of the universities at Cork, for example, and lecturing and things like that. I want to see if I can bring that image up here, but it's this one here. So just with reference to you doing testing of different instruments or research, there was this instrument here and I was kind of fascinated with this one. So what is this here, or what are you showing here?
So this is a road survey I did in 2014 or thereabouts, using to basically detect the volume of jamming systems that were used in vehicles on Irish roads. And it's a 3 or 4 day survey driving around Irish roads, detecting signals, jamming signals. So the orange light you see there, there's actually two lights, which is an indication of a something on the GPS frequency. And the fact that there's two indicates that it's getting stronger. And as we get close to the vehicle, it increases vertical, number of lights vertical. And what we found in that survey was quite a lot of commercial vehicles. No surprise, I guess, and we've talked about it earlier. A lot of commercial vehicles had little jamming devices on them. And I don't know whether you have the same phrase, the white van, those kind of people around the place. It can be just to avoid being tracked, but it can be for other nefarious reasons. Which may or may not be obvious, immediately obvious. But it was mostly commercial vehicles. We saw the presence of jamming devices. And in that case, driving close, as you got close to the vehicle, the number of orange lines increased. And we could see we had a GPS device with a measuring signal strength. So you could see the signal strengths of the GPS disappear. And it was very obvious what we were looking at.
you keep telling me that these instruments are really cheap and fairly low cost or whatever. And I was thinking there was somebody somewhere, you know, making these intricate devices that were blocking signals and things like that. But it doesn't sound like it's all that difficult. And, you know, you can buy an instrument that can also detect who's actually jamming the signals, which is really curious to me.
And Kronos make devices to detect that of vehicles going in and out of airports and seaports, because we talked about earlier the potential to jam GPS and remove timing, because timing for all kinds of communications is very important. So that's is safety critical. And so many big international airports will have a detector at entrance points to detect for jamming.
Interesting. Here, let me get, we just got a few more and then we're going to wrap up in a little bit. But Kyan, in regards to GPS fixing, your experience, is there an average time this takes, or is it just so variable that you can't put a number near it? So I guess getting a fix for GPS.
So on what they call a cold start, so starting your GPS receiver in a new position, several hundred kilometers from where it last was or just after purchasing, can take 2 or 3 minutes because it needs to download the Almanac, which is all the codes of all the satellites, so it can do its electronic stopwatch calculation. So that could be, reasonably slow. If you've moved a short distance and it's within a couple of days of the last position, your fix should be within 10, 15 seconds. Nowadays, though, and that's all down to the Almanac. Nowadays, on a mobile phone device, the Almanac can be fed using the internet directly into your phone, so it doesn't have to wait to download it. It just fed into it. Almanac is where each satellite is in space and the code that it's presenting and the cycle it is in the code, and that all has to be fed into your GPS receiver or updated in your GPS receiver so they can calculate position or accuracy. In the first couple of seconds of a GPS calculation, it tends to be least accurate. So, you know, you could be talking about 15, 20 meters, and then it'll refine itself over seconds. So cold fix, slow calculation, short time after last used in a position not too far from last used, happens fairly quickly. And then mobile phone devices, there is no delay because the Almanac is fed.
I got a question here from Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome. Is GNSS universally available across the globe? Are the number of viewable satellites reduced towards the poles?
Low Earth orbit satellites and communication satellites traditionally were over the equator, so they were directional. And they were geostationary, so they had to be over the equator. With GPS, they're global, so there's no reduction over the globes. That's what gives it its global quality. And GNSS, all the providers, so we're talking about American Navistar GPS, the original. We're talking about Galileo, European GPS, which is now fully operational. We're talking about GLONASS, which is Russian. And we're now talking about BeiDou, which is there or thereabouts and operational. They're all global services, so all readily available, codes readily available, all usable. But they all can be denied if need be.
So, Gary, what is next for you? I mean, you've been doing a lot of work. You're doing other things going on. Are you working on any just like cases right now? Is that pretty much what you're doing? Do you have other little projects on the side? What can you tell us about what you're working on?
Yeah, so I have 2 cases at the moment. And, you know, yourself, it takes a while to get the investigation analysis done and get a statement and a report done. So we have that going on, with some of them due in court during this year and maybe early next year. So that's what I would say to you is, because of the prominence of the crimes and because of the prominence and proliferation of GPS, now something that was once every couple of years is now once every quarter in terms of my effort. So that's number one. And that's going on all the time. I still keep my hand in with surveying. I rent out GPS equipment and I handle data for people. So I'm still conscious and aware and viewing on a daily basis how GPS is performing. So that's going on. But my aim right now is to get a course in a university here in Ireland set up to teach what we're talking about, geospatial forensics.
That's excellent. Yeah, that's a great idea. I've never released, I mean, I've heard people talk about GPS, but having it in a course, I think would be a great idea. I don't think there's anything out there like that. Or is there, do you know of anything that's out there right now?
No. It's accepted and has been accepted that if you present GPS, that's it. It is what it is. But I've managed to get across the vulnerabilities and the vulnerabilities in relation to evidence today, and maybe hopefully we'll get people to think about it.
Excellent.
And see how we can get on with that.
Let's do this. I've got folks. I'm gonna paste the in the chat window here. This is Gary's Global Positioning Intelligence website. And we were laughing before because it's G-Pint, and for some people that means something different to other. But he's got some information here. And there's also a brochure. So if you click on this link that's right here, and that brochure will take you here. So Global Positioning Intelligence, and there's some other information. He's also got a good article here. I'm going to paste this one into the chat window as well. But this is on LinkedIn. And so He's got a number of articles, actually. It says here 39 articles. Is that so?
Yeah, some of them are commercially focused rather than of general interest. So, this one is particularly kind of feeds into the geospatial forensics in terms of identifying the provenance, the accuracy, the reliability of data for all kinds of purposes, including for evidence.
Okay. And Gary, if anyone wants to get a hold of you, they can just go either like through your website or actually yeah. I'm going to click on your LinkedIn here. And I think I asked you about this before, but folks, if you want to reach out to Gary, he's also here on LinkedIn, and you could always send him a message or a connection request if you have any questions. Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, look, Gary, thank you so much. It's great information. I honestly have never, spoken to anyone as informed as you on this particular subject. And I'm really glad that I met you. I'm glad that we were able to connect here and transmit your knowledge here across. And I'm hoping that people have learned something from this one.
Well, I hope so too. But I have to thank you for the opportunity to come on, and really appreciate it, and wish you all the best with all that you're doing. And because someone should interview you, Eugene, because the amount that you're doing is enormous. Your work. So congratulations. I don't know how you get through the day.
Yeah, well, we try. We push forward. So, yeah. Hey, look, do me a favor. Hang back because I want to come back and just chit-chat with you. So just stay with me for a bit, okay?
Okay.
All right. Cheers, Gary. Thank you. All right, folks, that's it. That's 100th episode. And I want to thank everybody. There was a few comments there. So thank you for the questions. Thank you for the comments. Some good things happening here. Look, folks, have a wonderful Thursday. Thank you so much for the continued watching and support. We'll see you soon, and have a happy Thursday. Bye-bye.